All right. So we're continuing this morning with class number 10 on our class on church history. This is under the title Awakenings in America, 1662 to 1875. You'll see in the back, we've got a little handout for you that you can go back and grab. And really, what we're going after this morning will be looking broadly at the type of churches that were in the North American colonies in the 17th and 18th century, and then what became the United States. Thinking about revival, we'll think about in particular in New England the influence and role of what's called the Halfway Covenant with Jonathan Edwards and his grandfather Solomon Stoddard. We'll think about Edwards, his view of the issue of affections as it relates to revival, conversion, things like that. Then we'll take some time to distinguish the first and second Great Awakenings. So the first Great Awakening was in the mid-1700s. Second Great Awakening was in the early to mid-1800s. And we'll note some similarities and differences, and then the influence of Charles Finney on American revivalism, American churches today. So we've kind of covered a good amount of ground, and what I'll do is I'll just kind of start first with when you think of the American colonies and you think about what was going on in Britain and Europe in the mid-1600s, what are some of the reasons that people are emigrating, moving over to the American colonies in the 1600s? What are some of the reasons?
Religious persecution.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. There's persecution. So some groups are fleeing, right, and heading to America and the American colonies. Whether it's imprisonment, you know, fines, or worse. What else? What else would be some of the reasons? Yeah.
Economic opportunities, cheap land.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. All those things, right? So people are willing to take the trek, especially because land's fixed in England. Most of it's, you know, by an elite class, right, that own the land. So there's really not a lot of opportunity, right? So people are willing to move. What else? What else, what, you know, may have influenced, you know, if you will, American colonialism? And cause that's going to be the backdrop of...
Are we limiting it just to the 1600s?
Or 1700s, yeah.
Okay, or think it's all the way to the 1800s.
Correct, yeah. Because
I was going to say, in Ireland, they have the potato famine.
Yeah. Yes. Because of some of the different, starvation and other things. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So there's going to be a mix, if you will, there's a mix or melting pot that's moving to the colonies, right? And it's for different reasons. There's going to be different religious dynamics depending on the colony you're in, right? South Carolina or Georgia looks different than Connecticut or Massachusetts, right? Not only with religion and law and other things. And so a lot of those things are going to kind of play into this new world, right? So that kind of gets us thinking and talking. So what we'll do is we'll kind of transition now into thinking about churches in the new world. So we'll start with a question. What is a revival? And that's a rhetorical question. The idea and language of revival has always been popular in American Christianity. How many of you all have ever been a part of maybe a church or church group where it was like, you know, we're planning for revival, we're going to bring in a preacher, or, you know, maybe, you know, I've had some kind of experience like that, you know? Or maybe you've gone to a revival like, I was going to say Billy Graham, but I think like his, you know, like if you will, like a crusade, right? Like a modern day, you know, crusade. They rent out a stadium, you know, and yeah. So those would be maybe a couple examples we think of today. But, you know, while it's been popular, the idea of a revival, the idea of what constitutes a revival maybe has less agreement, right? Okay, well, what really constitutes a revival? And how does a revival happen, right? Is it primarily a supernatural work that God does who employs fallible sinners? Or is it primarily a work of preachers employing the right means, pulling on emotions, right? You know, if you will, emotional fanaticism. And connected with these questions are a host of theological assumptions that we'll try to think through over the course of this teaching. Assumptions about how God works in the world to draw others to himself, the church, responsibilities of other Christians, and many others come into view in the early history of Christianity in the British colonies in North America. In today's class, we'll look at a few different answers to these questions. We'll discuss the first and second Great Awakening by considering the ministry of some during that time. We'll think about, in particular, Jonathan Edwards and George Whitefield. For additional context, it's worth considering what was the state of churches in the American colonies from the late 17th century, so 1600s, to the early 18th century, right? So the 1700s. And the answer to the state of the churches really varies by region and colony. And so this is helpful. This kind of gives you a lay of the land with church type by colony and area. So there was a large Episcopal or Anglican establishment to the south. So when you think of different areas there, all the way down to, like, let's say a Georgia. And then you have Puritan Congregationalists, Nonconformists to the north. So you think of, like, Connecticut would be an example, or Massachusetts would be really strong congregational churches. Now, if you guys remember, what is a congregational church, right? If maybe you remember, we talked about Presbyterian, Congregational, Baptist, a lot of overlap. What was the difference, let's say, between a Presbyterian and a congregational church? Does anyone remember? Yeah.
Maybe like church government.
Yeah.
The congregation would be more people of that particular congregation have a say in matters as opposed to the budgetary overarching.
Yep. Yep. Very, very good. Yeah. So the congregants, yeah, exactly, would be able to, you know, there would be consent given in regards to church leaders to be included or to be dismissed, church discipline, things like that. Yeah, very good. Yeah, and additionally, kind of building on that too. So while there was agreement between congregational and Presbyterian churches in regarding baptizing infants, there was a distinction made because Congregationalists said that infants of believing parents, or at least of one believing parent, are not included in the covenant community of church membership. Right, and so Congregationalists would only say that those who have believed on the Lord, are converted, are those who can apply and be a part of church membership. Whereas Presbyterians would say, if you're baptized into the church, right, you're a part of the church covenant community. So that became one, if you want to call it Reformation or additional reform. And then Baptists, right, went one step further. So, but some of these different groups in regards to the view of the state were similar between Presbyterians, between Congregationalists. So Congregationalists, like in Connecticut, believed in a state church, right? There was an establishment there, or Massachusetts, Boston, and areas like this. So that kind of gives you a feel a little bit. So more the Puritan, you know, congregational, nonconformist, more to the north, and then more Anglican south, Virginia, South Carolina, Georgia, areas like that. Baptists, Presbyterians, Quakers, and later Methodists would all emerge in the New World during these times, and their churches would all face different challenges. Now, it's helpful to think of three sets of colonies. So New England, like we were covering, largely Puritan. The middle colonies, religiously diverse, Roman Catholics, Quakers, Presbyterians, Dutch Reformed, Baptists. And then the southern colonies, nominally Anglican and Catholic in Spanish Florida. And though we won't spend more time on these distinctions, it's helpful to have them in your back pocket, if you will, as we kind of think about some of the contextual factors with gospel ministry in America's early history. And for our part, we'll largely focus on what started in New England and made its way to other colonies. So in New England, by 1662, so if you guys remember from one or two previous Sunday schools, the Great Ejection in England, right? So this is, you have many first, so as a result of the Great Ejection in England, many first-generation American settlers were beginning to die out physically, and their children lost much of their spiritual fervor in New England. Church membership had high admission requirements, including recounting a conversion experience. Church membership was declining, and nominal Christianity was increasing. Now, if you remember, it's required everyone is to go to church in this time, right? And so that's going to play an influence on so a high view of church membership, and yet there's going to be pressure to deal with the problem. An advisory convention was formed and recommended what became known as the Halfway Covenant in 1662. This covenant recommended that New England congregational churches allow for the baptism of the grandchildren of regenerate church members. That is baptism for children whose parents were unconverted. So understand the order there, right? So you have people converted, and then their children were baptized as infants, right? Those children never were converted, and now they've had children. And then the push is, well, hey, we would like those children to be baptized, right? And so the push then became, well, it's not just children of a believing parent, but it could even be the grandchildren of a believing parent. So that was a push with this halfway covenant. Problems continued for the next 40 years, and in 1700, Solomon Stoddard changes the halfway covenant to allow both the regenerate and unregenerate to be admitted to the Lord's Supper. So that's another development that comes. And the reason for that, converted members of congregations were allowed to take the Lord's Supper. Now Stoddard advocated opening up the table to all who wanted to partake. The only exception was those whose lives were scandalous. Stoddard held that the Lord's Supper was a converting ordinance, meaning individuals could be converted through taking it. Though the actions of one pastor in one congregation shouldn't be taken as representative for all the church in that time period, nevertheless, it was Solomon Stoddard's influence in the region, how he was esteemed, and the problems that this would create for those who would come after that makes this example stand out in this period. He was considered by some to be the Pope of the Connecticut River Valley, and in that sense, he was widely respected, and his example was followed. Now, we can observe a change in emphasis with such changes to the ordinance of a church. Positively considered, the halfway covenant and the decision of Solomon Stoddard and others were a means to gain a wider hearing for the gospel. They softened their exclusivity in an effort to welcome the unregenerate and more broadly influence society. The question that arises, however, is did these ministers have sufficient grounds or authority to change an ordinance that Jesus instituted for his followers? And that is a good question. Despite these challenges, it's in the context of these churches where revival would begin. Revival was already happening in England, and as it moved to New England, these halfway members would be some of the first fruits under Solomon Stoddard's ministry. But the flowering of such awakenings would come under Stoddard's grandson, Jonathan Edwards. And we'll turn to consider Stoddard there, or I'm sorry, Jonathan Edwards there. But before we do, does anyone have any initial questions, kind of like religious makeup, thinking about, you know, British colonies, North America? Yeah.
So you say Congregationalists thought that they still believed in infant baptism.
Correct.
But not the child was baptized, but not a member of the church.
Correct. Correct. You had to have a profession of faith to be a member of the church. Yeah. So that and that's, yeah, to the point of where Baptists really just kind of took that one step further. Yeah, from the Congregationalist position.
Do you know why did they baptize them? Because like modern argument here for it is to admit them to membership.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a good question. I think it's gonna be a mix of things. Some will see with covenant theology, and so there'll be maybe a similar reason as a Presbyterian, but then they'll see the strength of the New Testament position of who are the members of a church and see priority there, but yet also see continuity with the Old Testament. And I think you can see some overlap between the two. Yeah. Yeah, but you definitely feel that tension. Yeah.
My mom's Armenian, right? And I was baptized in the Armenian church as an infant. I mean, obviously,
yes.
Later I did get baptized.
Yes. Yeah, 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 yeah. I saw the air quotes.
I had to baptize you because if you had died as an infant, we couldn't have buried you in the Armenian cemetery otherwise.
Interesting.
So, So I think, like, you know, like culturally, like it's a, like, exclusion thing if mm-hmm. you're not
yeah.
in there. So it might be something similar in the American colony.
Yeah, 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 fair point. All right, good. Any other questions? All right, let's go ahead. We'll hop in. So we're going to consider Jonathan Edwards, George Whitefield, and then more broadly, just revival in the American colonies. All right, let's do this. All right, so Jonathan Edwards, let's first look at childhood and conversion. So Edwards was born in 1703 in Connecticut. He was the son of Pastor Timothy, and his wife was Esther Edwards. He entered Yale College at the ripe age of 13. Yeah, so if any of you are thinking, you know, you've progressed in life, yeah, you hear something like that, and you just, yeah, kind of take it back. Early in his life in ministry, he embraced the Reformed Protestantism of his father. From August 1722 to April 1723, he pastored a Presbyterian church in New York City. Later in 1726, he was called to Northampton, Massachusetts, farther north, to be an assistant minister to his grandfather, Solomon Stoddard, in a congregational church. In 1727, he married Sarah Pierpont in New Haven, Connecticut. Then in 1729, Solomon Stoddard died, and Edwards became the senior pastor of the church in Northampton. Well, really, let's kind of get into revival. So description of the revival. So over 10 years after Edwards began his pastoral ministry in Northampton, a remarkable revival occurred in 1741. Edwards describes the events in a letter. It was a very frequent thing to see a house full of outcries, fainting, convulsions, and such like, both with distress and also with admiration and joy. Around the same time, Edwards describes what happened after a Sabbath service when he met with all the children under 16 years of age. He says, in quote, "The room was filled with cries, and when they were dismissed, they, almost all of them, went home crying aloud through the streets to all parts of the town." Many would understand these outbursts as displays of conviction of sin as they were responding to the preaching of the word, but not everyone saw these experiences as being from the Holy Spirit. The revivals of Edwards oversaw as well as other contemporaneous revivals at the hands of men like George Whitefield proved enormously controversial and divisive in New England. Much ink was spilled as people analyzed or defended or attacked these very revivals. Edwards' ministry grew in this period. He worked to understand and to carefully think through what was behind such actions and the characteristics of true conversion. After these early revivals, Edwards saw many who seemed full of spiritual joy sadly return to worldly ways. And so he considers such problems in perhaps his most well-known work, Religious Affections. How many of you maybe heard of Religious Affections or maybe have read through a piece of it? Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, where you can see he tries to work through, okay, what really is a working of the Spirit of God versus what's just like emotionalism, right? Where people are just emotionally affected. And so let's consider that for a minute, a theology of religious affections. So written in 1746, in this work, Edwards analyzes what are the reliable and unreliable signs or affections of true spirituality. He argues true religion in great part consists in holy affections. We should note, when Edwards says affection, he does not mean a display of emotion divorced from reason and will. It is more like an invigorated and visceral engagement of the will. Just the strong thinking, right, that reveals itself in emotions, right? It's connected, not disconnected from what we normally think is the mind and thinking and those things. Edwards held that religion must have good deeds attending these affections, but affections were essential. True religion consists so much in the affections that there can be no true religion without them. He who has no religious affection is in a state of spiritual death. Additionally, Edwards attempted to distinguish between true and false affections, listing signs of them. Right, so you can see trying to think through and wade through some of these. And he quotes here, actually, it's on your notes there. There are false affections, and there are true. Who can go ahead and read that for us? He'd be willing to read. Yeah, great.
There are false affections, and there are true. A man's having much affection don't prove that he has any true religion. But if he has no affection, it proves that he has no true religion. The right way is not to reject all affections, nor to approve all, but to distinguish between affections, approving some, and rejecting others.
Okay, excellent. Now, let me just go ahead and ask a discussion question. Do you think the Bible agrees with what Edwards is saying here? Or are there any concerns or cautions we should have with what Edwards is saying and regarding the affections and the state of someone's soul? What say ye? Yeah.
Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also.
Okay.
I think, you know, in other places, Jesus and the apostles and even the Old Testament would commend, you know, the disposition of our mind and heart towards something.
Yes.
You know, a window into the spiritual, you know, kind of angle towards it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Good. What else? Yeah.
Yeah. Christ said, "You will know them by their fruits."
Yep.
We're talking about false teachers, but it, in the same way, like, you will know each other mm-hmm. by how we live, and mm-hmm. what we're doing, and what drives us. Is it to worldly ends, or is it to the end of the kingdom of God?
Yeah. 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 Very good. Very good. Yeah.
I think just going along with that, like James 2, right? Like, faith that works is dead. Like, real faith does produce fruit.
Yes. Yep.
Is that, do you think that's kind of what it's
doing? Yeah. Agreed. And that those works are not dry works, right? But there's a work on the heart where there's something new that's desired, right? You know, love for Christ, finding, you know, loveliness, that Christ becomes precious, right? He's the treasure, if you will. But now, can there be dangers with this, or with an emphasis of this, right? And there can be, right, in regards to introspection or thinking assurance solely comes from looking inside and whether or not, you know, are my desires strong enough? And sometimes people can get wrapped around the axle and kind of lose sight of assurance that comes from Christ, right? And seeing his, you know, completed work. So, but it's good, though. I think what Edwards gets at, I think he's trying to discern some helpful things. In matters of discerning true faith, Edwards does seem to overemphasize affections and work to discern affections and diminish looking for an orthodox confession and accompanying fruit of the Spirit, right? We think of like the parable of the sower, right? Where there's some who initially receive it with joy, right? But then what happens later, right? That there's the fruit is choked out. And I think that's good. All right. Well, let's briefly just talk about Edwards' change of views and then his dismissal. So by 1748, Stoddard's revisions to the Halfway Covenant had permeated the church in Northampton for 48 years. In that December, Edwards told someone that they must profess Christianity before they could join the church. His statement sparked no small controversy and much discussion and writing between Edwards and others on this topic ensued. Now think about that, right? Like today in our context, would that spark great controversy, right? And maybe it depends, right? If we're talking with, you know, maybe a Presbyterian or someone else who says, no, you know, children of you know, believing parents are included. But generally, in Baptist circles, this isn't going to be something, right? But in some of these other contexts, this is going to be more controversial, right? Maybe there's a blending, right, that people are seeing. And so really, this is going to lead to his dismissal. So leading to the events of June 1750, where a congregational vote on Edwards was held. Upon this vote, only 10% of the members voted to retain Edwards. Now think about this. So this is after you see revival. There is a spark of people coming to Christ, you know, major influence, right? And yet there is something that's deep within society and the thinking of the church as it relates to the Halfway Covenant, right? And only 10% of the members are going to vote to keep Edwards. So while it's likely that many issues contributed to his dismissal, right, it's not only that, the most substantial was his change to the communion practice. Edwards knowingly took a controversial position on principle, despite its causing significant trials for families and knowing that it may well lead to his dismissal. However, in a twist of irony, despite his dismissal, Edwards regularly filled the pulpit at the Northampton Church for several years, as they unfortunately would not find a replacement. So now let's think a little bit more broadly, right? So if that's in Connecticut, right, and Edwards, right, one ministry being in the church, Now we're going to kind of step back and think about the spread of revival through the ministry of George Whitefield. Now, what do you all know about the man George Whitefield? What do you know? Yeah.
He was a remarkable preacher, and help me out here. Was it Whitefield that Benjamin Franklin famously, he said that he liked to listen to him preach?
Yes.
Is that my point?
Yeah.
Somebody asked, like, Benjamin Franklin, why do you like listening to him? You don't even believe what he says. And his response was, yes, but he really believes what
yes.
he says.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, how many of you, so I saw a commercial, and I think it's called A Great Awakening. Did you all see that? Or The Great Awakening? I don't know. I don't know if it's
For the movie?
Yeah, the movie, yeah. But it's kind of, again, I don't know much, so don't take it as my endorsement. But it looked like it was helping display this relationship between Benjamin Franklin, George Whitefield. Yeah, it was said that Whitefield's name was more well-known by the time we got to the Revolutionary War and American independence than George Washington, right? Now that says something. Yeah. George Whitefield. All right, so let's kind of hop in. So childhood and conversion. So 1714 to 1770 is when he lived. Whitefield was born December 1714 in England at the age of 21. So he was born a poor family. At age 21, he was a student at Oxford, and he seems to have been converted through the reading of a book by Henry Scougal called The Life of God and the Soul of Man. I mean, you all maybe heard of that book or heard of that work. Yeah. Yeah. And so he was married to Elizabeth James in 1741. So just real quick synopsis there. So he's a gifted preacher. Whitefield was a skilled orator and an ardent evangelist. It seems that many of Whitefield's hearers, even unbelievers, were deeply affected by his rhetoric, to like what you said about Benjamin Franklin. Sarah Edwards, the wife of Jonathan Edwards and a friend of Whitefield, described his preaching as this. Whitefield makes less of the doctrine than our American preachers generally do and aims more at affecting the heart. He is a born orator. It is wonderful to see what a spell he casts over an audience by proclaiming the simplest truths of the Bible. I have seen upwards of 1,000 people hang on his words with breathless silence. Additionally, the famed English actor and playwright David Garrick remarked that Whitefield could make men weep or tremble by his varied utterances of the word Mesopotamia. Yeah, which is probably some exaggeration there, right? But I think you're getting the picture. There was just a deep, heartfelt preaching, right? Not only a simplicity, but a sincerity. It was the unbelieving philosopher David Hume thought it worth going 20 miles to hear him preach. So let's look under doctrine. So Whitefield was a fiercely evangelistic preacher and a staunch Calvinist. He saw the Reformed doctrine of election as fueling evangelism rather than hindering it. He said, "I cannot see how true humbleness of mind can be attained without a knowledge of it." That is election. God's free choosing. And though I will not say that everyone who denies election is a bad man, yet I will say it is a very bad sign. For if we deny election, we must, partly at least, glory in ourselves. Now, let's think for a minute about the breadth and scope of his ministry. While it is impossible to know the exact statistics surrounding how often Whitefield preached and to how many, the numbers really are staggering. Now, remember, this is not the time period of planes, trains, and automobiles, right? This is horse and buggy. You know, you're going to build a wood pulpit if you build something, right? It's very manual. But these numbers are staggering. As one summarizes, in his 34 years of ministry, Whitefield preached some 18,000 sermons. 18,000. Often to multiplied thousands. If informal messages are included, such as in private homes, this number easily increases to 30,000 sermons, perhaps more. Three sermons a day were common. Four were not uncommon. Conservative estimates are that he spoke 1,000 times every year for more than 30 years. In America alone, it is estimated that 80% of the colonists heard him preach. Yeah, wild, right? It's estimated that he preached to 650,000 people per month during 1739. That would be at like the height of the Great Awakening and revival, or 20,000 people per day. Where the revivals in New England occurred mostly in connection with the regular pulpit ministry of the local church, where you know, he'd be welcome to preach, you know, and the reality is these churches would be filled. People would actually gather outside the churches, right, or open up the windows and sit up there and listen. But that wouldn't be the case in other areas. Whitfield would preach extensively outside of the church, both in terms of physical location and spiritual oversight, you know. As one historian said, Whitfield combined an extraordinary disregard for inherited church traditions with a breathtaking entrepreneurial spirit. This proved consequential for American Christianity. Over against the Reformation, Whitfield's methods partly divorced preaching and the pursuit of godliness from the ecclesiastical structures. Let's see here. I'm just going to make a quick comment here. In part, some of this is going to come from the schism that's going to be caused with these revivals, because you're going to find that some are going to be in favor. Hey, we're seeing people genuinely come to know the Lord, right? Even though there might be some tares among the wheat, right? Just like odd, like convulsions, people just crying and things going on in some of these meetings. Nevertheless, a lot were genuine. A lot were genuinely converted. And you'll have others who will say these revivals is fanaticism. People are losing, you know, just a rational mind engaging with the Orthodox faith. You know, some of these people who be raised up as itinerant preachers are not trained or not approved, and so there's a concern there. So you're going to see a division in these colonies. And in one sense, Whitfield did apply to, you know, he would ask ministers, "Can I go and preach in your pulpit?" And he'd be denied access, or, you know, a congregant might give him, or someone with access would give him, you know, key to the church, but they would, how many are familiar with this term? Lock the pews, right? So pews would be chained, right? And so people would gather in the church but couldn't sit down because the pews were chained, right? So again, you're going to see a lot of this. And it didn't help that in the midst of controversy, you know, sharp words can be spoken or hot words, right? And so it just maybe created more of a divide. So you see a lot of this going on not only in America, but you see this also going on in England, right? That there's going to be this, you know, a conflict, especially with Anglican priests and bishops, right? You know, some would be in favor, but a lot, there's going to be a lot of antagonism, a lot of headbutting, if you will. Though extraordinary in the scope of his ministry, the ministry of Whitfield underscored some of the problems Edwards saw among churches in New England. Long-term spiritual growth happens primarily through the local church, not gifted or flashy itinerant ministers and the subjective effect of their preaching. Spiritual health cannot be judged by a crowd or a mass following, but is best espoused over time. But at the core of Whitfield, preaching was the enduring doctrine of the Reformation. Still, in some ways, Whitfield helped lay the ground for what we would see today as parachurch ministries, and, you know, for the better or for the worse. Now, what I'll do is I just want to spend a couple of minutes and just kind of pull on that thread a little bit. So now, Whitfield would be what we describe today as a Methodist, but when we normally think of the Methodist, we don't normally think of George Whitfield. Who do you think of when you think of the Methodist?
Wesley.
Yeah, Wesley, right? Yeah, John and Charles Wesley. Now, what was the major difference between John and Charles Wesley and George Whitfield?
Calvinism.
Yeah, Calvinism. It ended up being the doctrine of election. And so, there was still correspondence, right? But that ended up being a rift between them. Whitfield would really be the spearhead behind the Calvinistic Methodists, right? And you'd see that back in England or in Wales. There was revival that was taking place in Wales and Scotland and in England. Some of the precursor, when we think of, for example, open-air preaching, right? So where it was, hey, you know what? We're just going to go out to the masses. We're going to go to the markets. He would go to the what were they called? The colliers, the miners, right? And just go and preach to them. And so there would be this willingness to go outside the church. But if you remember, you know, really the persecution that happened really in the previous century probably was probably the forerunner to some of that, right? So you have individuals meeting under persecution, right? Nonconformists. And so they would be finding places outside of the church to gather, pray, hear preaching, right? And so that probably influenced and made it feel more justifiable. And it was interesting. Even Whitfield, one of the things, one of his justifications with the first open air preaching he did before he went to the coal miners was there was no church in that area. Therefore, if I go and preach, I'm not really violating, you know, the standards from the Anglican Church. And, you know, it was his way of kind of working that out up front. But it really is fascinating. And one of the strong things for Whitfield and for the Wesleys was really to create a strong relationship between America and Britain with a strong evangelical ministry, right? You know, and so I think, I don't remember the exact number, I think Whitfield, I think, traveled the American, the Atlantic Ocean some 13 times, right? I guess, let me say this. I don't want to present a view only of George Whitfield as this, you know, hero who didn't have any flaws, right? What one flaw would be his very low view of marriage, right? So how many of you guys have read the book? I can't remember it. But it compares and looks at three marriages. It looks at John Wesley, it looks at George Whitfield, and then it looks at Jonathan Edwards. And in that order, in regards to like how they viewed and treated their wives in regards to marriage. Wesley, unfortunately, was the bottom. Whitfield was just a couple steps above. And then Edwards was a significant role model, if you will. So all of our heroes have warts, right? That's probably just a good way to just come back. All right. So summary of the first Great Awakening, right? So first Great Awakening, you know, early, mid 1700s. So on the matters of revival, we see in the first Great Awakening, it's what will be contrasted, especially what we saw up in the northern part, would be a regular means of grace, right? Through the preached word to individual consciences, ordinary means were used to gather church, the preached word, things like that, and extraordinary fruit was seen. The working of the First Great Awakening turned many from religious nominalism that pervaded the American colonies in the 18th century. The preaching of Edward and Whitfield emphasized familiar themes, but pricked the conscience of many as they were dealing with a holy God and sinful humanity. Additionally, one of the other things that comes up is this is really going to be a boon for Baptists, right? Baptists really will start to flourish in this time period. Especially as there's an emphasis with conversion, fruits, and those things are needed for baptism and church membership in the local church. And it was the preaching of the scriptures and sound doctrine that drove many to reconsider their previous position, maybe what they were raised in, and led to a regenerate church membership rightly being prized, that the church is made up of professing believers. Now, let's go to the second great awakening. How many of you all are familiar with Charles Finney? Maybe you've heard the term, name. Okay, yep, all right. So the Second Great Awakening, and we'll start under Churches After the War for Independence. By the late 1700s, under 10% of the population belonged formally to local congregations. The reasons for this varied. In battle-worn areas like New Jersey, New York City, Philadelphia, the Carolinas, congregational life had been disrupted and many members displaced. In other regions, after the war, the priority for many was building a new society and economy. These pressing concerns left little time for church life. With newfound freedom, others thought about leaving traditional Christianity behind. Many frontier areas to the west were entirely devoid of Christian influence. Though fraught with much difficulty and challenges in a new nation, the work of revival would continue. Different from the first Great Awakening, however, these series of revivals can't be identified with one individual as a preeminent example. There were stirrings of revival as early as 1795 through 1810, and the work would continue until the Civil War. This period is notable for its diversity in forms and substance. Though emerging in the period of the First Great Awakening, Baptists and Methodists came to prominence in the Second Great Awakening. As we will see, what started with the ordinary means of grace in Edward's Northampton change, these new measures were introduced in this period and different fruit was seen. Some of these new measures can be seen in the Cane Ridge Revival of 1801 in Kentucky. Missionaries and itinerant ministers planned a series of protracted meetings known as camp meetings, where many came to hear the gospel preached. In Cane Ridge, thousands came to hear black, white, Presbyterian, Methodist, and Baptist ministers preach the gospel. Quote-unquote, electrifying results followed. Several responded dramatically, and churches were established as enduring witnesses in these communities. Such protracted meetings grew, especially in frontier areas. And as they grew ever detached from churches and doctrinal oversight, theological lines became blurred. Among such efforts, the Reformed commitments that supported the preaching of men like Edwards and Whitfield ended up being lost. Such a shift is best seen in the ministry of Charles Finney, whose ministry emerged later in the 1820s. Now, who is Charles Finney? On your notes. So Charles Finney was born in Connecticut, 1792. In the fall of 1821, Finney was made a profession, said that he was converted. 2 years later, in 1823, he was ordained to the New School Presbytery. From 1824 to 1827, he worked as an itinerant evangelist throughout New York. It's said that powerful revivals sprung up under Finney's multi-week campaigns. Then, in 1836, Finney faced such severe criticism of his writings and revivals that he left Presbyterianism to join Congregationalism. A year later, in 1837, Finney joined the faculty of Oberlin College. He ended up dying later in 1875 as the best-known evangelist of his generation. He is regarded as highly influential in the history of American Christianity and known as the father of modern revivalism. Now, when you think of Charles Finney, for those of you who know Charles Finney, do you normally think of his theology as good or bad? Yeah, bad. Yeah, yeah. And there's going to be a reason for that, and we'll see some of the fruits that kind of come along with it, that get tucked in with it. So, general theology. Let's touch on some of these. In his life and ministry, Finney ardently rejected Calvinism. He denied the imputation of Christ's righteousness. Denied penal substitution, and instead affirmed a moral governance theory of the atonement. He argued the doctrine of imputed righteousness, or that Christ's obedience to the law was accounted as our obedience, is founded on a most false and nonsensical assumption. Christ's righteousness could do no more than justify himself. It can never be imputed to us. It was naturally impossible then for him to obey on our behalf. Those are some pretty strong words. So now, where else have we seen a denial of the imputation of Christ's obedience in the doctrine of justification? As you think about church history, where else have we seen that?
Pelagian.
Yeah, Pelagian. Yep. Where else?
Rome in general.
Yeah, Rome. Yeah, the Council of Trent. Right? Yeah. Yeah, this would be, an old era resurrected, if you will, right? Finney rejected the traditional Protestant view of justification by downplaying the one-time nature of justification. Whenever he sins, he must, for the time being, cease to be holy. This is a quote from him. This is self-evident. Whenever he sins, he must be condemned. He must incur the penalty of the law of God. The Christian, therefore, is justified no longer than he obeys, and must be condemned when he disobeys. Or antinomianism is true. Until he repents, he cannot be forgiven. In these respects, then, the sinning Christian and the unconverted sinner are upon precisely the same ground. Can you consider how terrifying that is? Yeah, I mean, this is what happens when the law and the gospel become conflated. We have a wrong view of justification, a wrong view of sin. Could you imagine giving this counsel to a sincere Christian with a wounded conscience, right? Yeah, this is, oh man, this is really, really bad. Additionally, he rejected depravity of man, instead believed sinners could immediately repent Finney thought a moral obligation implies a moral ability. Now, what does that mean? What he's saying is, if God gives a command to someone, that means that man not only should, but man must be able to obey it, right? So you can kind of hear his philosophical reasoning. Well, that wouldn't be fair for God to command something that man couldn't do, right? Because of a fallen will. That would be wrong. So he uses that as his justification. Finney harshly criticized Presbyterians for lacking emotional fire and conviction in their preaching. He wrote about their contentions and janglings are so ridiculous, so wicked, so outrageous. There is a jubilee in hell every year about the time of the meeting of the General Assembly. So he had just fiery, punchy words, right? Yeah, and you can see just a very, very low view of doctrine, of God, of justification and these things. He rejected the doctrine of original sin. Sinners are bound to change their own hearts. That was a sermon he preached in Boston. I mean, this is just giving you a feel for this guy's theology, right? Now, why is this important? Well, this is important because this is the guy, he is the father of modern evangelical revivalism, right? How many of you guys have ever been to a summer camp, right? And, they played music for like 2.5 hours, right? To get people to come forward, right? Yeah, this is... This is coming from Finney, right? So Finney would create what's called the anxious seat or the mourner's bench, right? You can kind of see that if you go to your last page there. Yeah, the anxious bench and the protracted meeting, right? Just a very, very heavy emphasis on human emotion. And why is that important? Give me a second here. So he believed that because man has the ability to repent and because there's something that man can do, yes, God is in the overall picture, but really if you can work on those heartstrings, there can be real lasting change and bring people to Christ instead of a view of, I want to be faithful and preach the word as God intended and prick consciences, right? Not to say that, you know, like the preaching of Whitfield or Edwards didn't strike emotion, but you see a different emphasis in what it's trying to achieve, right? All right, this is what happens when I start to get off of my notes. all right, so we talked about the anxious bench, and so the parallel with the anxious bench today is what we call the quote-unquote altar call, right? So when we think of the altar call, right, this is where it's coming from, right? It's coming from the anxious bench. Right, and essentially it was, if you wanted to talk to someone about the sermon afterwards, you'd come forward, right? If you wanted to be saved, you would come forward, right? And so this is it was called the anxious bench, right? It was those, I don't know what's going to happen to me, or the mourner's bench, someone who's been deeply affected by the preaching, and they come forward, and really, in one sense, you can see that there's a heart behind it that wants to see people saved. People are affected, and you want to give them counsel. You want to help them come to Christ, right? But then there's also the tradition that comes behind it. Now, what does the altar call practically replace in Baptist life? What does the altar call really come to replace? This is not meant to be a trick question, but it is a little trickier, tougher.
Lord's Supper.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. So it really gonna it'll be both the ordinances, right? Baptism, right? Because there's a sense of like, hey, I want to come forward, right? And profess Christ, right? And how did the church normally do that? It was recognized in baptism. But then for some people, they would come forward and it was a recommitment, right? A rededication of their life to Christ. But really, that's happening in the Lord's Supper. When we take the Lord's Supper, we're recommitting ourselves to Christ, right? We're, if you will, renewing with the Lord, right? But you can see how... It wasn't intentional to replace, right? But just in practice, right? How emphases can sometimes rechange maybe priorities or what gets preference or emphasis. All right. So really, really interesting. Kind of, if you will, trying to capture revivalism, you know, in some of the different Great Awakenings. And then later we would get into like the Third Great Awakening. How many of you are familiar with someone like a Billy Sunday, right? Or a Dwight Moody, D.L. Moody, right? This would kind of be later in the late 1800s, early 1900s, right? And so that would kind of be in a similar stream. All right. We've kind of talked about a lot. Does anyone have any kind of questions, thoughts, comments with just some of the material kind of getting into, the Great Awakening? Yeah.
So would a good summation of the differences between the first and the second be the First Great Awakening emphasized what God does, and then the Second Great Awakening was emphasizing what man can do or ought to do?
Yes. Now in the Second Great Awakening, you're going to have a mix of preachers. Yeah, because you'll have like, I'm trying to remember the guy's name. Isaiah Nettleton, I think is his name, right? But he'd be more Calvinist, right? But yeah, but you're definitely getting more... more Arminian. You're seeing a lot more itinerant ministry, frontier ministry, guys who are not educated or receiving a formal education, ordination, and things like that. And so there's going to be a downplaying of those things. And then that kind of becomes the fruit of it later. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, what else? Yeah.
Such a contrast with somebody like Charles Finney versus George Whitefield.
Yeah.
And to me, it highlights the truth of back from the Reformation of sola scriptura, that as Christians, we might have a love for listening to people on the internet, or we just always have to have that filter of God's word. And the comment you made about Finney, where he said that a moral responsibility implies a capability.
Yes.
Like that is the definition of man-centered.
Yes.
Like
the
definition depends upon the man.
Yes.
As opposed to
yeah.
That this is wrong because God is holy. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with your ability. Right?
Yes.
So, yeah, I'm feeling a bit nauseous from all that Finney theology.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I was going to say, I feel like it all boils down to whether or not which comes first, regeneration or faith. Mm-hmm. If faith precedes regeneration, the person has to come to God and then get the new heart from God and be transformed, then I actually think all of his practices make logical sense if it's us who have to come to God first versus God circumcising our hearts and giving us faith, repentance,
yes.
and gifts, and then we come to him.
Yes.
So it's terrible stuff, and yeah, I mean, I agree with Chase, it's nauseating, but like it does seem like a practical, logical following of the rejection of the doctrines of grace.
Yes.
It would make sense that you were going to just try to persuade people as the paramount thing if faith precedes regeneration.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's good.
And yeah. I'll ask, when you were preparing and studying for this, did like the backdrop to all this is the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Did you come across that at all? Like, how did they, all this that we're studying about, like, how did they reconcile that, which kind of what was going on? Or was that talked about, or...
Yeah, it's interesting. So in the American Revolution, you're going to have Christians one that are divided between being loyalists to England. I don't know if this is going to answer the question or not. So just tell me from the right direction. You'll have some that are loyalists, and you have others who see a principled reason where the king and his excesses are going too far, and so there's going to be a push to reject the authority and what will be really the Anglican Church. And you already see some of that going on. And there's going to be a sense of a push more for independence, right? Some of those ideas are going to be affecting each other between individual conversion and people taking responsibility and other things. But there was definitely a divide within the American colonies in regards to the revolution, should we be, shouldn't we be submitting to the government? There was definitely a divide between the two, but I don't know if that's answering the question.
Yeah.
It is really fascinating to read because both were using theological justification to ground what they were doing, right? No, it's right for us to submit these things and, to change, and others. Yeah. Yeah. Or even along denominational lines, like you have the Anglicans, right, who are, siding and being loyal and, with the king. Yeah. Well, all right. I just want to share one more quick story. So during the time of Whitfield, so I absolutely love reading stuff about George Whitfield. If you ever get a chance to read about some of the stuff with Whitfield, it's honestly, it's just fascinating, just and very almost exciting, right? You read this, and it was like he would go, and there would be a fire spark, right? And then 20 years later, right, like you could still see some of it. Well, anyway, so one of the things that took place was at Yale College, and Whitfield did a preaching tour, an itinerant preaching tour, an open air preaching at Yale, and this created a spark. At the college, right? And so one of the men who ended up being converted, Samuel Hopkins, he ended up, it turned this university campus almost into like an evangelism and discipleship grounds, right? Where they're almost like just, there's constant talking, students wrestling in their consciences. How many are all familiar with David Brainerd? Right, yeah, famous missionary to the Indians. He's going to be an evangelist there. He's coming in. It was really just a fascinating account to see how God would even work, like in college students' lives, right, and would raise up men to be used in many different ways. So, all right. Well, that was my quick little story. Let me go ahead and pray. Father, thank you so much. I thank you, Lord, for this time and for this discussion. I pray for your blessing. Even now as we head in for morning worship, we ask it through Jesus Christ. Amen.